Welcome to another ABC Radio National podcast. For more information, go to abc.net.au/rn.
You probably hear about a lot of migrants being disappointed when they first come out here. Well, I was disappointed for a different reason, because they dropped us off in the city the first day. Time we got here, and I looked around and thought, oh no, this is no better than England. I want to go out in the bush.
Hello, I'm Annie Thompson. Thanks for joining me. On Verbatim today, meet Peter Blythe, who left England as a young lad of 17 in 1957, dreaming of wide open spaces and a rural lifestyle. A far cry from a less than idyllic childhood in southern England in wartime.
I can remember running down the air raid shelter every time the siren went off, and we used to see the searchlights up in the skies and hear a bit of gunfire and the odd bomb falling around the place. And we'd sometimes hear the droning noise of a doodle bug, we used to call them. They were V2 rockets. They'd sort of hum for a while, and then suddenly the noise would cut out and we'd sit there and hold our breath and wait for the explosion. But one particular evening I remember I was looking out the front window of our house, and suddenly all hell broke loose and there were bombs exploding, sirens wailing and people screaming, and three houses across the street were just reduced to rubble in front of my eyes. Actually, those air raid sirens, if ever I see a movie or something on the radio and they've got those air raid sirens going, I still get a chill right up the spine. We lived in a condemned house, actually. They were condemned before the war, but so many houses got knocked over in the war, they had never had money to rebuild, so we were stuck there. And I actually stayed there until I was 17 when I left England. But, yeah, the house was just crawling with rats and mice and bed bugs, and we used to get bitten every night with them and all that sort of thing. Food and clothing were scarce. They were rationed and very hard to get. Clothing was all just second-hand cast-offs, you know, old stuff from the rag and bone man's carton. I mean, it's not like the stuff you get in the op shop today, because people never threw anything out that was very much good anyway. I would reckon that most of the people around our street and around our area were living like that. Some of them a bit further up the town were a lot better dressed than we were, and we were looked down on a bit, because a lot of class distinction in England. There was the upper class, middle class and working class, but they used to refer to us as the lower class because it made them feel better, I suppose.
There were four boys in Peter's family, and he was the second eldest.
I got on reasonably well with my brothers, but none of us got on with our father. He was a very violent man. He didn't drink, but he threw in work fairly early in the piece. He reckoned he was too sick to work, but he still used to fight in the street, and he had a bad reputation. He had a reputation for breaking bone and drawing blood, and people used to cross the street to get away from him. My mother was a very small, and the old man was a very big bloke. My mother was very small, and he continually verbally abused her all the way through. And he used to talk to her like she's a dog half the time, but he didn't actually hit her. But he used to get into us pretty well. He wasn't a father for me at all. Over the road where I told you those houses got bombed out, they built a wood yard over there. It was second-hand timber, and they also had firewood and that there. And I used to work over there after school to get some money, because the old man wasn't working. Then once I left school, I went over there and worked from full-time. We used to go around to the demolition sites collecting scrap timber and whatever, and then cut it up for firewood. And any doors, window frames and stuff that could be used were stacked in the yard and resold. And one day I went with the boss and we loaded the truck up with gear, and I just loaded the truck because I was told to, and the next thing the cops were on our tail, and it was stolen gear, and I didn't know. But my boss went to jail, so I went to work in a factory after that.
What was that like?
Pretty depressing. Mass production, sheet metal work, and it was very noisy. The work was just sort of, well, being mass production, it was just repetition work, very monotonous. And we were always being poked and prodded to work faster. They'd come along and, come on, get a move on, this sort of thing. Talk to you like your dogs, you know. And there were a few accidents there. I saw one fella lose half his hand in a guillotine. And I saw a woman's scalp when she got her hair caught in a revolving chuck. Just tore her hair right off. And, you know, and it was just a shocking place to work. I I'd sort of made my mind up for an early age that, you know, my lifestyle there was just rubbish, and the only way I could go from there was up, and the only way I was going to do that was to get out. And by the time I was 17, I was raring to go anyway, but the final decider came when my old man started abusing my mother there one day. I'd had enough. I'd been doing a bit of, you know, you get a bit mixed up in the way the lifestyle is over there. I'd been doing a bit of street fighting, and some pretty rough stuff went on around the back blocks over there. And so I decided that was enough, and I just told him to back off. And he came at me, but I stood my ground, and I punched him twice in the face. And I've never forgotten the look on his face, because the blokes in the street wouldn't stand up to my old man. And to see one of his sons do it, I think it just took him back there for a little while. That's probably why I got a couple in. But after that, he just took me to the cleaners, so to speak, and he never came near me after that. He never spoke to me from then until the time I left England.
Why did you choose Australia, Peter?
It's funny, really. It sounds a bit silly. When I first thought about going somewhere, I thought, now I want to get as far away from this place as possible. And I'd heard Australia called Down Under. And I thought, now, if it's Down Under, it's about halfway around the world. And if I go any further, I'll be coming back, so that'll do me. But I rode away to Australia House, and they sent me some details of this group called the Big Brother Movement, who sponsored young boys out from 16 years onwards. And they brought you out, set you up with work and accommodation, and appointed you a big brother or legal guardian until you turned 21. And they told me that Australia was a land of opportunity, and if I was prepared to work hard out here, I could have my own car, my own house, even my own farm. Well, I didn't know anything about farming. I had no idea at all. I was a town boy over there, but suddenly I had this idea in my head. I thought, I'm not running away from England. I'm going over there to get myself a farm. The day I left England, my mother asked me to make peace with the old man. So I went in there and tried to talk to him, but he just sat there with a stony look on his face, and he wouldn't even talk to me. And anyway, I tried and tried, and I looked at the clock, and the time was getting away. So I said, well, anyway, I'm going to Australia. And for the first time in 6 months, he spoke to me. He said, you can go to so-and-so hell if you want to. So I just said to him, OK, I'll save you a seat, and I walked out. And we had to walk down to the railway station, and my mother walked with me, and my younger brother walked with me, and we had a push bike there with a big suitcase and another thing piled on top of it. And we got down to the railway station. By the time we got to the station itself, the train was already leaving. And so I just grabbed one case, and my brother grabbed the other, and I had an old guitar there with me too. And we ran for the train, and I jumped up into the goods wagon. The door was open, and just jumped up into the wagon there, and the next thing, the fella on there was reading the riot act to me about, you can't board a train like this and that, but it was too late. I was on, I wasn't getting off. And by the time I'd finished arguing with him, I looked back, and my mother and brother were out of sight, and I never saw my mother again. I was a bit upset when I got on the boat, of course, and parents were allowed, like, onto the boat at the same time. There was a lot of other people coming. There were 1,600 passengers, but friends and relations were allowed on the boat. And most of the boys were there with their mothers and fathers, or some only had one parent. And they were all shaking hands and kissing and crying and carrying on. And I looked around, and there was no one there for me, so I thought, oh, bad luck, you know. And there was a woman standing there, and I think she was probably just, I don't know, she was trying to feel sorry for me or what she was, but I wasn't in the mood for sympathy. And she called out to her husband and said, oh, look at this poor boy, he's got nobody with him, all on his own. Where's your mother, you poor boy, you know? And I basically told her to get lost. I wasn't, I think I told her to sod off or something like that. It wasn't very nice.
And this experience, Peter, that was the subject of the first poem that you wrote.
The first night on the boat I wrote that, actually. Went down into the cabin, and the boys down there were crying and carried on, and there was a smell of sweat and bad feet and all sorts of stuff. You imagine 8 boys in a cabin, because we were crammed in the cabins 8 at a time, and we were right down near the engine room in our cabin, and there was just the heat and the noise and the vibration. It didn't look like we were going to get to sleep anyway. And with all these other boys crying and that, I thought, oh, I don't need this. So I got out of it, and I went out on deck and walked to the end of the boat, and I'm sitting there watching the foam drifting away behind us. And I started thinking about what I was leaving behind and what I might be going to, because I didn't really have a lot of idea what I was going to. And while I was sitting there thinking about all this, the words started forming in my head, and they just started falling into rhyme, which was a surprise to me, actually, because I'd never written a poem in my life. Now, I'm not much of a sailor, but my life has been a failure, so I'm heading for Australia, far across the sea. I'll leave the rats, the bed bugs too, the bosses with their come here you, and all the other bastards who thought they had shares in me. Toiling in the factory's racket, 50 hours, a small pay packet. There's a lot of people hack it, I don't think I can. And though I'm only 17, I think it's time I left this scene and put 12,000 miles between myself and my old man. Well, our first sight of the Australian coast was at Fremantle. We were off for about half a day and then got back on again, but we were supposed to be met by, I can't remember the name of them, it was some league or other that was supposed to meet us and show us around a bit and give us a meal, and the bus never turned up and nothing happened, and there was a fellow standing on the dock, and he said, what are all these boys waiting for? And our escort officer told him, and he said, well, I got a farm out the road there, he said, bit of a farmlet, he said, why don't we bring them out there? He said, we'll see if we can get them a bit of a meal going out there. And we couldn't believe it. They took us out to this bloke's place, and his wife and daughter were out there, and they got all this meat and stuff all appeared from nowhere, and they fed the lot of us, and they let us pick lemons off their tree. We'd never seen a lemon growing. And after we'd had a feed, we sat around, and the daughter played the piano, and we were singing all these songs. You know, she had a songbook there, and we were singing the ones we knew. And I just felt like these are real people, you know, and why didn't I have a family like this and all that sort of stuff. And they started singing this song, you know, the one, Bless This House, and I was singing at the top of my voice. Bless the roof and chimneys tall, let thy peace die over. Halfway through, I realised I was the only one singing. And they were just sitting there looking at me, you know, and I didn't know if I was the only one that knew the words or not, and I thought, well, she's still playing, so I just kept singing. And when I finished, the lady from the house, she was crying her eyes out. And I said, oh, look, I'm sorry, I didn't want to upset you, you know. And she said, oh, no, no, that's great, you know. We finally got off at Sydney, and we were met by people from the Big Brother movement in Sydney. And the ones who were going to work in town were taken to a hostel in town, and the rest of us were taken to a training farm at Liverpool in New South Wales. And the idea was to get us acclimatised to the conditions, and we worked there for about 6 weeks, and we were milking cows and feeding the pigs and chooks and digging the vegetable garden and all that sort of stuff. It was really more or less to get you acclimatised. And eventually they found a job for myself and another fella over in Tasmania, and we got on the plane and flew across there, and we were more or less, I wouldn't say slave labour, but we were cheap labour for their friends and for their cronies and that sort of stuff. And we were sort of working from daylight till dark and really overworked and treated like second rate. You know, you get a lean-to on the side of the house, and the only difference between me and their dog was that I had a bigger kennel, because I actually spoke to the dog a little bit better than they spoke to me. But I had a fella that had been appointed my big brother in Hobart there, and I told them what I thought of their movement and made one of my own, and I just took off.
You're listening to Verbatim on ABC Radio National, and we're with Peter Blythe. After cutting his association with the Big Brother movement, Peter did a few odd jobs in Tasmania until a friend suggested they both head to Western Australia in search of bigger money on the goldfields.
We went to Norseman and got a job on the mines there. That was actually where I met my wife there. She was the daughter of the boarding housekeeper.
And you and Jill were married in Norseman, weren't you?
We were married in Norseman, yeah. It was about 110 in the water bag.
But Peter's vision of a rural life was still very much on his mind.
And when I came over to the west, there were a couple of fellows working on the mine that were doing the same thing that I eventually finished up doing myself. They were working underground to earn the money, and they were developing farm at grass patch and salmon gums, and they told me about this conditional purchase land. So I applied for 3,000 acres down there, and I got a letter that had been redirected to say that I'd been allocated the land, but due to an oversight on their part, they'd forgotten to notify me. And if I still wanted it, they wanted to know. Otherwise, they were going to throw it open for selection again. And, yeah, I wanted it.
The land was at Salmon Gums, near Esperance, on WA's south coast.
It was just bush. And so you couldn't really see very far, you know. I mean, you couldn't see for the bush for the trees type of thing. But once I got the first bit of clearing done and put a little bit of a shed up there, I built out an old second-hand iron and bush timber and stuff and put a bit of a place here I could sleep and a bit of a stove in there so I could stay down there on weekends and tidy things up a bit. And then I sort of started to get the feeling that I'm doing some good, but it took a while because I didn't have much in the way of money. But I guess the first time that it really hit me was when the first crop went in. You know, all the work that goes into cleaning up the stumps and burning all the sticks and cleaning up, there's a hell of a lot of stuff to clean up. And every time you plough it, more comes up and you've got to clean that up. And you work and work and work, and you think, you know, when's this ever going to end? Worked on the mines and I saved all me dough. Took up some land. Thought I'd give it a go. Good move, I thought, but I'm stuffed if I know. This farming's a strange bloody game. Cleared all the trees, but the regrowth still shoots. Stumble around in me old hobnailed boots, stacking and burning them big mallee roots. A man should keep fit in this game. One day I got a paddock right and I put a crop in, and the first time I went down there to have another look at it, and the crop was out up about an inch high, and it was green from one end to the other, and I thought, wow, this is it. It was just such a feeling you couldn't explain, you know, it's really happening, you know. That was when I really decided, yes, it's happening.
Clearing his 3,000 acres at Salmon Gums was a weekend job for Peter at this stage. Monday to Friday, he worked in the mines around Norseman in the WA goldfields to support his young family. The work underground was often dangerous.
And I worked underground for 10 years, actually, and I had a couple of close calls. The first one was I hadn't been underground very long and I didn't know a great deal about it, and I was rigging up the pulleys for a scraper to scrape the dirt down to an ore pass. You had to drive a pin in with a wedge into a wall and hang a block on it, then run the rope through it. And I went up there and I had a look, and there was a bit of a crack in the they call it the hanging wall, that's the roof. There was a bit of a crack there, and I thought, oh, that doesn't look too good. So I went over and saw the miner, and I went over and asked him if it was all right, and he said, oh, yeah, that's okay. He said, I've tried that. That's, no worries about that. He's as good as gold. And I went over there and I walked up to the face and I banged the pin in and hung the block up, and I just reached down to get the rope to hang it in the block, and I just felt this bit of a draft behind me and a thump, and this slab came down. It would have probably weighed about half a ton, and it took the back right out of my boot. It just wrecked the back of my boot and put a bit of a cut in my heel, but it wasn't very bad. Yeah, I went home, and somebody said to me, oh, you ought to buy a lottery ticket. I said, no, I'm wasting time. I said, I've had me luck for the day. There's a dreaded sound in the underground that a miner gets to know when he's on his own, working all alone, several hundred feet below. And he casts his light where it's black as night for a place that's safe to walk, and he holds his breath. It's the voice of death when the ground begins to talk. I've had a couple of other... I've heard the ground talking. When I first came out, I met a bloke over in Tasmania, out in the bush, an old fellow, and he said to me, if you stay out in the bush long enough, you'll get to the stage where you talk to a fence post. He said, you put your hat on the fence post and talk to it. So anyway, I remembered that, and I was underground there one day, and a fella came out to the where we were having our lunch, and he said, oh, he said, I'm not going back in there, the ground's talking. And he was an old bloke, and I looked at him and I thought, oh, he's been here too long. But then I found out what the talking ground was, because I spoke to one of the other miners, and he said, it's the sound that it makes when it's peeling away, just before it falls. And it wasn't all that long after that I heard the ground talking, and I climbed up and stood under a pillar, and the next thing down came this great lump, and away she went. But the worst experience I had of the lot was when Meckering was wiped out with the earthquake, because the tremor came right through there to Norseman, and I was 5,000 feet underground and about 2 miles in from the shaft, and I was working by myself, and I couldn't work out what was going on. Suddenly everything was just shaking. It was unbelievable the way it shook, and the noise, and my eardrums felt like they're going to burst, and there's rocks flying off the walls, and I knew I had to get out, and it took me a fair while to get out. So I found my way back out to the plat and I rang through to the surface and asked them what was going on, and they said it was an earthquake. And they said, oh, the good news is that you're the last one out, so everybody's safe. And at the time when it was happening, I started thinking, well, maybe this is the last day I've got. And I started thinking about my wife and kids, and I wondered if I'd growled at my kids before I left home or if I'd actually left on a good note. I was trying to remember everything I'd said. And I thought, when was the last time I told them I loved them, you know? All that stuff goes through your head.
Before long, though, Peter left the mines and moved his family to Salmon Gums.
When you started farming full-time down in Salmon Gums, how much did you know about farming? I mean, were you learning on the job, or had you read up, or did you learn from other people?
I was learning on the job, basically, because I'd never planted a crop before anyway, and I'd certainly never harvested one. Actually, when I went to harvest the first crop, the bloke next door said to me, oh, when are you going to start your harvest? I said, oh, as soon as you're ready. He said, well, he said, you told me you haven't driven one. He said, I'd better come over and show you how to work. And I said, oh, well, if you wouldn't mind. So he came over, and after he'd gone, I thought, that's no good, because he's got his crop to take off. He doesn't want to keep coming over here for me. And if I'm going to learn this job, there's one way to learn, and that's to do it. So that was what I did. Any time anything went wrong, I stopped and said, oh, looks like that's come undone, or this and that. And I battled my way through it. It took me a long time to do it, but I took 1,200 acres of crop off with that old header, and I never called him back once. I just said, you've got to learn this job, because if you're going to do it for a living, that's it. You have to know what you're doing. It's a funny thing, really. I mean, I sort of, you know, I never really felt like this is my land. I knew it was my land. It was going to be eventually, once I got it all cleared and squared up with the lands department, it would be my land. But I knew it belonged to me in that sense. But I just felt, well, this is where I belong. You know, I just felt so much at home there on that farm that I thought, well, I'll never want to leave here. And I was actually surprised that I did leave it, you know. I thought I would never leave it. I just used to get up every morning and think to myself, you know, why would I want to be anywhere else? Because this is exactly where I have to be. This is it, you know.
And that was it for 23 years. Peter and his wife Jill have now retired, if that's the right word, and live just outside Albany on WA's south coast.
The place we bought has got 40 acres. And I've got a few cows and a few sheep on there just to keep a hand in, and so I don't feel at a loss altogether. You can't put the brakes on, you have to change down gears. That's the secret. If you put the brakes on, you come to a stop, and that's no good. I've changed gears. My rhymes are all written, my tales are all told. I followed my rainbow and found my own gold. Enough to last any man till he grows old. Until it's all over, Red Rover. My journey was long, but my feet didn't drag. I carried my all in an old leather bag, wrapped up in a blanket. I called it me swag, and travelled all over, Red Rover.
Where did the sense of humour come from, Peter?
That's a good question. I was a cheeky little sod at school. I've always had a bit of an ability to come back. I think it's because when I was a kid, people used to try to rubbish you, and I wouldn't accept that. But the other thing is that I've got a philosophy in life I've had for as far back as I can remember. If you've got an adversity of some kind and you can laugh at it, you're not necessarily going to beat it, but it won't beat you. And I reckon as long as you keep laughing, you've got your sanity, and I'm, fortunately for some reason, I've always managed to be able to do that.
Some memories cheer me, some leave me quite sad. I've copped it all sweet, took the good with the bad. The hard slog's all done now, a bloke should be glad to know it's all over, Red Rover. But maybe the gold fever went to my brain, for looking back now it becomes very plain. If I had 10 quid, mate, I'd do it again. I'd do it all over, Red Rover.
That was Peter Blythe on Verbatim on ABC Radio National. Ian Manning was technical producer, and I'm Annie Thompson. Thanks for your company here on ABC Radio National.
You've been listening to another ABC Radio National podcast. ABC Radio National.
on air and online, with many of our programs available as podcasts or MP3 downloads. All the details at abc.net.au/rn/podcast.